This is the BBC.
We've got a little extra Westminster Hour podcast for you this week. The programme included an interview with Tony Blair's former speechwriter, Philip Collins, about speeches that shaped the world. We thought you might enjoy hearing a longer version of the interview that we broadcast, in which Philip discusses famous speeches by Winston Churchill, Nelson Mandela, Neil Kinnock and Margaret Thatcher, with the Westminster Hour's Duncan Smith.
That if the British Empire and its Commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Long years ago, we made a tryst with destiny.
You turn if you want to. The lady's not for turning.
A new dawn has broken, has it not?
Despite all the hardship we've been through, I've never been more hopeful about our future. I have never been more hopeful about America.
Great speeches from history there that have stood the test of time. What makes a great speech?
Well, the thing which you must have, which you can't fake or create out of nothing, is a great occasion. There needs to be something that you're talking about, which is a big event. And the career of Churchill illustrates this so well, because Churchill lavished great rhetorical verbosity on things that never warranted it. So all throughout his career, he was doing this. There's one instance in 1899, he's a by-election candidate in Oldham for the Liberal Party, and he stands before an assembled group of a handful of people, and he says in a very sonorous way, never before in the history of England have so many people had so much to eat. And it's really flat. He does the same thing again in Africa as a colonial secretary. He says, never before in the history of Africa has so much water been held up by so little masonry. And it's you can see the structure, you can see where that's going to end up. But suddenly, when it's the war and Britain's in peril, and never before in the field of human conflict has so much been owed by so many to so few, it's not just that the rhythm of that last one's better, it's also that the moment it warrants it. So the combination of really fine writing with a very momentous occasion, that's what makes a speech that will last.
We're going to listen to some speeches from history that have stood the test of time. And let's start with Nelson Mandela, here speaking in 1964 at the Supreme Court of South Africa.
During my lifetime, I have dedicated my life to this struggle of the African people. I have fought against white domination, and I have fought against black domination. I have cherished the idea of a democratic and free society in which all persons we live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an idea for which I hope to live for and to see realized. But my Lord, if it needs be, it is an idea for which I am prepared to die.
This is a court hearing rather than a political event, but we remember it and the words echo through history.
They do, and it was an extraordinary speech, and Mandela is essentially pleading for his life. He expects to get a life, a sentence of death, which he doesn't, as it turns out, but he thinks this is distinctly possible. And there follows a long silence after he says that. And then eventually it's broken by the judge saying, you may call the next witness. It's an extraordinary moment. The whole of that speech, which was a very long speech to the jury, was really an account of Mandela as an African nationalist. And he's trying to forswear the idea that he's a communist. So there's a real Cold War aspect to that speech as well. It's very detailed, very forensic, and he was himself a lawyer. And it's a court speech. And then at the end, he raises himself to that rhetorical height. It's the only part of the speech which he learned. So he delivered that part that we heard just there, directly looking at the judge. He laid down his script and he stared at him. It was must have been absolutely extraordinary. But you see there that it's only at such a moment that you can risk rhetoric of that kind, you know, an ideal for which I am prepared to die. Now, you can't say that about housing benefit reform. You know, it's got to be big. It's got to be enormous. Otherwise, it's not decorous, to use Cicero's technical phrase. Decorous means meeting the occasion with your words. And that's what Mandela does there. He rises to his height. He says it quite sotto voce. He doesn't gild it with his delivery because the words are enough. You don't need to reach for incredibly theatrical delivery if your words are that strong.
We've been listening to recorded speeches from history, but in your book, you're further back than that, speeches that were written down. For example, Elizabeth I.
Elizabeth I, we aren't certain that the speech that Elizabeth I gave at Tilbury with the Spanish Armada gathering ready to invade was ever delivered. All we have is a letter about 35 years later by a clergyman called Lionel Sharp, but it sort of tallies with other things she said, and it's a wonderful speech in which she says, "I have the heart and stomach of a king," and she's answering the charge that a woman can't be in charge of the armed services. I mean, it's straightforward sexism. If it had gone wrong, it would have been ascribed to her gender. And she confronts it brilliantly. The older speeches, the classical speeches, such as Pericles, the funeral oration, which I think is the moment that the two stories of democracy and rhetoric begin. Of course, we don't have the Pericles press office sticking out the transcript. All we have is Thucydides' account in the history of the Peloponnesian Wars. So we are a bit reliant on hearsay and things which are written up many years after. The other great example is Lloyd George. Lloyd George is a great war speaker, the First World War. He takes over from Asquith largely on account of his ability to articulate the case for the war. But we don't have recordings of Lloyd George. And I think his reputation with respect to Churchill, his friend and rival, has suffered for that reason. It's partly because the Second World War is a more obviously just war than the First World War in popular imagination. But it's also that we don't have the recordings. And so we don't have an oral recollection of just how good Lloyd George was.
Let's move forward in time now to 1987 and Neil Kinnock speaking to the Welsh Labour Party conference.
Why am I, the first Kinnock in 1,000 generations to be able to get the university? Why is Glenys the first woman in her family in 1,000 generations to be able to get the university? Was it because all our predecessors were thick? Did they lack talent? Those people who could sing and play and recite and write poetry? Those people who could make wonderful, beautiful things with their hands. Those people who could dream dreams, who could see visions. Those people who had such a sense of perception as to know in times so brutal, so oppressive, that they could win their way out of that by coming together with those people, not university material. Couldn't they have knocked off all their A-levels in an afternoon? But why didn't they get it? Was it because they were weak? Those people who could work 8 hours underground and then come up and play football? Weak? Those women who could survive 11 childbearings? Were they weak? Those people who could stand with their backs and their legs straight and face the great... The people who had control over their lives, the ones that owned their workplaces and tried to own them and tell them, no, I won't take your orders. Were they weak? Does anybody really think that they didn't get what we had because they didn't have the talent or the strength or the endurance or the commitment? Of course not. It was because there was no platform upon which they could stand.
There's a romance there, isn't there?
There is. The two things you notice about that. One is the voice. What a beautiful speaking voice he had. I mean, the the tradition of an Aaron Bevin, who's another great Labour orator. The other thing is what a good case he makes. In other speeches, and in fact in that speech before the passage we heard there, Kinnock makes the case for state action to help people in the abstract. But what he does there is he dramatises it. There are real people and he's not feeling sorry for them. They're not victims of having no platform. On the contrary, they're incredibly strong people. The whole passage is about how talented, strong, etc. they are. And that makes it all the more potent. He's telling a story, which is a great thing to do in rhetoric, and he is posing the case in a really vivid way. And it's incredibly affecting. He was a great speaker, Kinnock. In my lifetime of watching British politicians, I think he's the best speaker. He was never there at a great moment of national history. He's more of an internal Labour Party speaker, completely transformed the Labour Party. And his extraordinary speech he gave in Bournemouth in 1985, where he expelled the militant, the grotesque chaos of a Labour Council. I mean, wonderful, really memorable stuff.
But at the time, did he get the respect you think he deserved?
I think within the Labour Party he did and still does, but within the nation, no, I don't think so. And it therefore also serves as an example of the limitation of rhetoric. You can't talk yourself out of a perception. It was the public, not enough of them thought he was prime ministerial. They didn't think winning the battle within the Labour Party was enough. And no matter how good Kinnock was on a platform, it didn't in the end make him appear to be a viable prime minister. So rhetoric can go so far, but it can't transport you if the rest of the political package isn't thought to be there.
But Kinnock clearly has a sense of drama. And our next speech is somebody who was trained to have a sense of drama. Of course, he was an actor who became the president. It's Ronald Reagan speaking in Berlin in 1987.
There is one sign the Soviets can make that would be unmistakable. Come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Phil, perhaps you can set the scene a bit here, why Reagan was in Berlin, what he was trying to achieve, and why this speech might have achieved it.
Well, this was in the midst of negotiations between the Americans and the Russians during the period of glasnost, of openness, and Mr. Gorbachev was offering concessions to the West and was suggesting that the hard-line communist years were coming to an end. And perestroika, openness. And Reagan was in a quite delicate series of conversations with him, and their relations were good. And Reagan was invited to Berlin, where Kennedy had spoken many years before, the famous Ich bin ein Berliner speech. And in fact, all American presidents then went back to Berlin and did a sort of Gettysburg address away from home. Reagan comes there, and the inclination of all the entourage was to do a very emollient speech. So Colin Powell is the Deputy National Security Advisor. He counsels against saying, tear down this wall. George Shultz, Secretary of State, also completely opposed to it. Peter Robinson was a speechwriter, and he found this phrase and gave it to the president, who, against all the advice of everybody else, decided in the limousine on the way to the Brandenburg Gate, where he gave the speech, that he'd just say it anyway. And it has become the speech, and it works perfectly within it. And it was not seen at the time as quite the escalation that the military advisers feared it would do, because it seemed reasonable. If it had been said 5 years before, it would have seemed a bit bizarre to say that. It would have seemed like an intimation of an American fantasy. Whereas at that moment, it seemed like the logical progression from where the talks had gone. And it's a very good example that there's pretty much no controversial phrase that will survive a committee of five or six people. In the end, the speech maker has to decide. And it's interesting in Reagan's case because there's no greater split between the speaker and the writer than there is in the case of Ronald Reagan. In that case with Peter Robinson, later with Peggy Noonan, some of his very best speeches, where really they did write pretty much all of it, and he delivered it. He delivers it so beautifully. As you say, he's a trained actor. He's really, really good at it. But he he wasn't massively involved in the production of the speeches, as most of the other people who've ever stood on that kind of podium are. They're intimately involved. But Reagan really was a deliverer, with the exception of that line where, in the end, he decided to do it. So the fiction has to be maintained. It is his line, because it was him deciding that the moment was right to escalate the political conversation in that way.
Reagan speaks with drama, but it's a completely different drama to how Kinnock was speaking. More effective?
Different styles for a different moment. I mean, Kinnock was more overtly and self-consciously rhetorical, is heavily theatrical and dramatic. Reagan, throughout his presidency, spoke in a very conversational way. He had a lovely way of speaking as if to everybody, and lots of people felt that when they heard it. He had a really nice, easy style. His voice was often was compared once like claret going into a glass. Kinnock is a different style. He's more of a church, of the Welsh chapel style. A lot of rhetoric comes out of church rhetoric. So Martin Luther King and Barack Obama, very strong sort of Baptist tradition in the way they speak. Reagan didn't. Reagan comes from television. Reagan is a 20th century speaker and one of those who mastered the art of the wireless and the television. And one of the changes of rhetoric is that you don't have to shout. If you are accustomed to doing speeches in halls and making yourself heard above the din, then you develop that kind of slightly histrionic manner. Reagan never did that. He was always speaking to a microphone. It was sort of like Frank Sinatra being the first person to master the microphone in popular song. Well, Ronald Reagan did that in speech.
Let's go to September 1988 now in Bruges. And maybe you can set the scene of why Mrs. Thatcher was there and what this speech was for.
Well, this is the College of Europe, and Mrs. Thatcher was invited to go and make a speech about Europe. And the initial idea of the speech was it would be a very pro-European speech. It was meant to be a mollifying speech where Britain would display its continuing commitment to the European Union. And that was the idea of the invitation being issued. And in fact, during the process of composition, two drafts circulated around Whitehall, one of which was full of protocols and pieties and courtesies, and the other, which Mrs. Thatcher preferred, was full of the sorts of things we're about to hear.
We have not successfully rolled back the frontiers of the state in Britain, only to see them reimposed at a European level, with a European superstate exercising a new dominance from Brussels. Certainly we want to see Europe more united and with a greater sense of common purpose. But it must be in a way which preserves the different traditions, parliamentary powers, and sense of national pride in one's own country. For these have been the source of Europe's vitality through the centuries.
Now, the legacy of this speech still sends ripples through today's politics. Why is that?
I think it does. I think this is the first major statement of serious Euroscepticism at the top of the Conservative Party. And it's because Margaret Thatcher defines the themes of Euroscepticism so clearly. You heard there the accusation that the Europeans are embarked upon a federal superstate, which still animates a great deal of the Brexiteers today. She goes on in the speech to also say that Europe is dysfunctional and bureaucratic and slow. And the reason for that slightly contradicts the first point, because it's apparently dysfunctional precisely because it's impossible to get anything done with so many competing national interests. Well, if that's the case, it's hardly likely there's going to be a federal superstate. But the anti-European cause has always run both those two arguments together. And Mrs. Thatcher did that in the Bruges speech. It's a very clever and clear speech, which again was given in defiance of many of the people who were involved in its composition, and led the question of Europe has accounted for a number of Conservative prime ministers since, and Mrs. Thatcher was eventually one of them. And it brought forth another famous speech by Geoffrey Howe. Not a good speech, in fact, the Geoffrey Howe speech in the House of Commons, in which he used the slightly tired and clunky metaphor of the cricket bat being broken by the captain, as if that's ever happened. But the effect was very dynamic, and eventually Mrs. Thatcher was forced out on this question.
You don't necessarily have to be a great speaker. I mean, would you describe Margaret Thatcher as a great orator?
I wouldn't, no. I think she was a serviceable speaker, but she often didn't really understand the jokes that she was making. I mean, the lady's not for turning. You turn if you want to. The lady's not for turning. I don't think she had any sense that that came from a twisted reference to Christopher Fry. But it sort of didn't matter because she did communicate a character and a persona through her rhetoric. And one of the tricks is to do that. And there are people who are technically good speakers who are a bit insipid as characters. You couldn't say that about Mrs. Thatcher. She had a resolution the way she spoke, and she conveyed a sense of certainty, which are great benefits as an orator.
It seems a lot of the speeches that we remember are made by male politicians. That may be a reflection on the society we're looking at in history. But do men have an advantage over women when they're public speaking?
I think the main reason that men dominate the history of rhetoric is the reason that men dominate the history of politics and the history of other professions. There are some people who think that the pitch of a woman's voice is too high to be rhetorically effective. And Mrs. Thatcher, for example, took elocution lessons to lower the pitch of her voice. But I think that's a fairly feeble reason for why women are so absent from the history of rhetoric. I mean, there are some who have got through. Elizabeth I, Emmeline Pankhurst was a very fine speaker, in fact was employed as a rhetorician. There's a great speaker from the Spanish Civil War called La Pasionaria, who should be better known than she is. But the main reason is that women have not been as prominent in the history of political movements as they ought to have been.
And now your book is called When They Go Low, We Go High, and that's Michelle Obama speaking at the Democratic National Convention in 2016. What made you pick that?
Well, it's a lovely phrase, and all of the best speeches can be described by a single resonant phrase, what we now disparagingly call the soundbite, but which actually is just a very clever way of encapsulating an idea in a short sentence. It's also that idea of going high captures what I'm trying to get at in the book, which is that great rhetoric is always in the service of a fine idea. Or at least the great rhetoric I defend, is in the service of a noble idea. It names an injustice and tries to correct it. And that at its best, is what politics can do. And elevated politics is better than populism. And so there's the counterposition in the book. They'll go low, the populists, and then in previous history, the tyrants, but we'll go high. And the high road is politics. And so ultimately, it's a defense of the political realm.
Is there a politician today capable of making one of these great speeches?
We are struggling at the moment for somebody of this sort of order. I don't think in British politics we've got anybody who's capable of making it into a second edition of a book. Barack Obama has just left office, is the finest speaker I've heard in a long time. He's remarkable and wonderful. Donald Trump is a very effective speaker. He's not one I like particularly, but his rhetoric worked. He has a style, he has a manner, and it's important to be vigilant because rhetoric always has two sides. There are wonderful speakers, and then there are speakers who are effective but undesirable. And rhetoric has always had that aspect, and that, in the end, is what democracy does. Camus, who's the great hero of my book, said the best thing about democracy that's ever been said, I think, which is that it's more important for what it prevents than for what it permits.
Why do you think we are struggling for a great speech maker today?
The main reason we always struggle for great speeches, speech makers, is that we don't have any great causes. So a last great cause in the American Republic is the ascent of a black man to the office of president. That's a remarkable cause. It may well be that the first woman in the White House would be a similar cause. But the democracies, by being successful in gradually and slowly eliminating problems and making the world better, therefore eliminate the capacity of people to lavish great words on things. So if you're Disraeli in 1872 in the Free Trade Hall talking about slums and public health epidemics, you've got really big, serious questions, and the solution lies in your hands of government. These days, that's not quite true. We don't have the same problems in the developed societies, and where we do, where we have large things like climate change, you don't have the executive authority. So if you stand up and make a grand speech saying how you're going to fix climate change, the immediate response of the audience is, well, you can't. It's too complicated. So the two elements that make for a great speech, the injustice plus the immediate capacity to change it, I don't think are as common now as they used to be.
And in this era of social media and multiple platforms for a politician to get their message across, is there a need for a great speech? And will there be a need in the next 10 or 20 years for these great speeches?
The great survivor of politics is the speech. It's an incredible thing that just about nothing has survived of the civilizational culture of the classical era apart from the political speech. The notion that someone walks up to a podium and communicates with an audience uninterrupted for 40 minutes is unchanged, and it still counts. We saw recently Theresa May, her political fortune, suffered another beating when she stood up and couldn't get her words out. It still mattered. It still made the news. So it does still matter. The way we disseminate the speeches is changing all the time through technological change, as it has in the past. We've always had to handle the accusation that rhetoric's worse than it used to be, and it will come round again. But it still matters against all the odds. The political speech is an extraordinary survivor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was the Times columnist and former speechwriter to Tony Blair, Philip Collins, talking to the Westminster Hour's Duncan Smith.